opposed to any involvement with Eragon, Nasuwada, the Empire, Galbatorix, Queen Islanzadi, or so far as Eragon could tell, any living being outside of the Beor Mountains. The Nurl Karathan were the stoneworkers' clan, and in men and material goods they had no equal, for every other clan depended upon their expertise for the tunnelling and the building of their abodes, and even the Injitum needed them to mine the ore for their smiths. And if Nardo's bid for the crown should falter, Eragon knew that many of the other lesser clan chiefs who shared his views would leap up to take his place. As Sweldon Rakanuin, for example, whom Galbatorix and the Forsworn had nearly obliterated during their uprising, had declared themselves Eragon's blood enemies during his visit to the city of Tarnag, and in every action of theirs at the clan meet had demonstrated their implacable hatred of Eragon, Sephira, and all things to do with dragons and those who rode them. They had objected to Eragon's very presence at the meetings of the clan chiefs, even though it was perfectly legal by dwarf law, and forced a vote on the issue, thereby delaying the proceedings another 6 unnecessary hours. One of these days, thought Eragon, I will have to find a way to make peace with them. That or I'll have to finish what Galbatorix started. I refuse to live my entire life in fear of Asweldon Rakanuin. Again, as he had done so often in the past few days, he waited a moment for Sephira's response, and when it was not forthcoming, a familiar pang of unhappiness lanced his heart. How secure the alliances between any of the clans were, however, was a question of some uncertainty. Neither Oric, nor Eorunan, nor Ganel, nor Nardo had enough support to win a popular vote, so they were all actively engaged in trying to retain the loyalties of the clans who had already promised to help them, while at the same time trying to poach their opponents' backers. Despite the importance of the process, Eragon found it exceedingly tedious and frustrating. Based upon Oric's explanation, it was Eragon's understanding that before the clan chiefs could elect a ruler, they had to vote on whether they were prepared to choose a new king or queen, and that the preliminary election had to garner at least 9 votes in its favour if it was to pass. As of yet, none of the clan chiefs, Oric included, felt secure enough in their positions to bring the matter to a head and proceed to the final election. It was, as Oric had said, the most delicate part of the process, and in some instances had been known to drag on for a frustratingly long time. As he pondered the situation, Eragon wandered aimlessly through the warren of chambers below Trondheim, until he found himself in a dry, dusty room, lined with 5 black arches on one side, and a bas-relief carving of a snarling bear 20 feet high on the other. The bear had gold teeth and round, faceted rubies for eyes. "Where are we, Quaestor?" asked Eragon, glancing at his guards. His voice spawned hollow echoes in the room. Eragon could sense the minds of many of the dwarves in the levels above them, but he had no idea how to reach them. The lead guard, a youngish dwarf no older than 60, stepped forward.
"These rooms were cleared millennia ago by Grimstance Borith Corgan, when Trondheim was under construction. We have not used them much since, except when our entire race congregates in Farthen Dur."
Eragon nodded.
"Can you lead me back to the surface?"
"Of course, Sergeant Lam."
Several minutes of brisk walking brought them to a broad staircase with shallow, dwarf-sized steps that climbed out of the ground to a passageway somewhere in the southwestern quadrant of Trondheim's base. From there, Quaestor guided Eragon to the southern branch of the 4-mile-long hallways that divided Trondheim along the cardinal compass points. It was the same hallway through which Eragon and Sephira had first entered Trondheim several months ago, and Eragon walked down it toward the center of the city mountain with a strange sense of nostalgia. He felt as if he had aged several years in the interim. The 4-story high avenue thronged with dwarves from every clan. All of them noticed Eragon, of that he was sure, but not all deigned to acknowledge him, for which he was grateful.
as it saved him the effort of having to return even more greetings. Aragorn stiffened as he saw a line of Azswelden Rakh Anuin cross the hallway. As one, the dwarves turned their heads and looked at him, their expressions obscured behind the purple veils those of their clan always wore in public. The last dwarf in line spat on the floor toward Aragorn, before filing through an archway and out of the hall along with his or her brethren.
"If Saphira were here, they would not dare to be so rude," thought Aragorn.
A half-hour later, he reached the end of the majestic hallway, and although he had been there many times before, a sense of awe and wonder overwhelmed him as he stepped between the pillars of black onyx, topped with yellow zircons thrice the size of a man, and entered the circular chamber in the heart of Trondheim. The chamber was 1,000 feet from side to side, with a floor of polished carnelian, etched with a hammer surrounded by 12 pentacles, which was the crest of Durgrimstin Jeetam, and of the dwarves' first king, Corgan, who had discovered Farthendur while mining for gold. Opposite Aragorn and to either side were the openings to the 3 other halls that radiated out through the city mountain. The chamber had no ceiling, but ascended all the way to the top of Trondheim, 1 mile overhead. There it opened to the Dragonhold, where Aragorn and Saphira had resided before Arya broke the Star Sapphire, and then to the sky beyond. A rich blue disk that seemed unimaginably distant, ringed as it was by the open mouth of Farthendur, the hollow 10-mile-high mountain that sheltered Trondheim from the rest of the world. Only a scant amount of daylight filtered down to the base of Trondheim. The City of Eternal Twilight, the elves called it, since so little of the sun's radiance entered the city mountain, except for a dazzling half-hour before and after noon during the height of summer. The dwarves illuminated the interior with uncounted numbers of their flameless lanterns. Thousands of them were on glorious display in the chamber. A bright lantern hung from the outside of every other pillar of the curved arcades that lined each level of the city mountain, and even more lanterns were mounted within the arcades, marking the entrances to strange and unknown rooms, as well as the path of Volturin, the endless staircase, which spiraled around the chamber from top to bottom. The effect was both moody and spectacular. The lanterns were of many different colors, making it appear as if the interior of the chamber were dotted with glowing jewels. Their glory, however, paled beside the splendor of a real jewel, the greatest jewel of them all, Isidar Mithrim. On the floor of the chamber, the dwarves had built a wooden scaffold 60 feet in diameter, and within the enclosure of fitted oak beams, they were, piece by precious piece, reassembling the shattered Star Sapphire with the utmost care and delicacy. The shards they had yet to place, they had stored in open-topped boxes, padded with nests of raw wool, each box labelled with a line of spidery runes. The boxes were spread out across a large portion of the western side of the vast room. Perhaps 300 dwarves sat hunched over them, intent on their work, as they strove to fit the shards together into a cohesive whole. Another group bustled about the scaffolding, tending to the fragmented gem within, as well as building additional structures. Aragorn watched them at their labor for several minutes, then wandered over to the section of the floor Durza had broken, when he and his Urgal warriors had entered Trondheim from the tunnels below. With the tip of his boot, Aragorn tapped the polished stone in front of him. No trace of the damage Durza had wrought remained. The dwarves had done a marvellous job of erasing the marks left by the Battle of Farthendur, although Aragorn hoped they would commemorate the battle with a memorial of some sort, for he felt it was important that future generations not forget the cost in blood the dwarves and the Varden had paid during the course of their struggle against Galbatorix. As Aragorn walked toward the scaffolding, he nodded at Skeg, who was standing on a platform overlooking the Star Sapphire. Aragorn had met the thin, quick-fingered dwarf before. Skeg was of Durgrimst Gedthral, and it was to him King Hrothgar had entrusted the restoration of the dwarves' most valuable treasure. Skeg gestured for Aragorn to climb up onto the platform. A sparkling vista of slanting, needle-sharp spires, glittering paper-thin edges and rippling surfaces confronted Aragorn as he heaved himself onto the rough-hewn planks. The top of the Star Sapphire reminded him of the ice on the Anora River in Palancar Valley at the end of winter, when the ice had melted and refrozen multiple times and was treacherous to walk over on account of the bumps and ridges the swings in temperature had cast up. Only instead of blue, white, or clear, the remnants of the Star Sapphire were a soft, rosy pink, shot through with traces of dusky orange.
"How goes it?" asked Aragorn.
Skeg shrugged and fluttered his hands in the air like a pair of butterflies.
"It goes as it does, Arjitlam. You can't hurry perfection. It looks to me as if you are making quick progress."
With a bony forefinger, Skeg tapped the side of his broad, flat nose.
"The top of Isidar Mithram, what is now the bottom, Arya broke it into large pieces, which are easy to fit together. The bottom of Isidar Mithram, though, what is now the top..."
Skeg shook his head, his lined face doleful.
"The force of the break, all the pieces pushing against the face of the gem, pushing away from Arya and the dragon, Saphira, pushing down toward you and that black-hearted shade. It cracked the petals of the rose into ever smaller fragments. And the rose, Arjitlam, the rose is the key to the gem. It is the most complex, the most beautiful part of Isidar Mithrim, and it is in the most pieces. Unless we can resemble it every last speck where it ought to be, we might as well give the gem to our jewellers and have them grind it into rings for our mothers."
The words spilled out of Skeg like water from an overflowing beaker. He shouted in dwarvish at a dwarf carrying a box across the chamber, then tugged at his white beard and asked,
"Have you ever heard recounted, Arjitlam, the tale of how Isidar Mithrim was carved in the Age of Heron?"
Aragorn hesitated, thinking back to his history lessons in Ellesmere.
"I know it was Durok who carved it." "Aye," said Skek, "it was Durok Ornthrond, Eagle Eye, as you say in this tongue. It was not he who discovered Isidar Mithrim, but it was he alone who extracted it from the surrounding stone, he who carved it and he who polished it. 57 years he spent working on the Star Rose. The gem enthralled him as nothing else. Every night he sat crouched over Isidar Mithrim until the wee hours of the morning, as he was determined that the Star Rose should be not just art, but something that would touch the hearts of all who gazed upon it, and would earn him a seat of honour at the table of the gods. His devotion was such that in the 32nd year of his labours, when his wife told him that either he had to share the burden of the project with his apprentices, or she would leave his hall, Durok said not a word, but turned his shoulder to her and continued grinding the contours of the petal he had begun earlier that year. Durok worked on Isidar Mithrim until he was pleased with its every line and curve. Then he dropped his polishing cloth, took one step back from the Star Rose, said, 'Guntera, protect me, it is done,' and fell dead on the floor."
Skeg tapped his chest, producing a hollow thump.
"His heart gave out, for what else did he have to live for? That is what we are trying to reconstruct, Arshatlam. 57 years of ceaseless concentration by one of the finest artists our race has known. Unless we can put Isidar Mithrim back together exactly the way it was, we shall diminish Durok's accomplishment for all who have yet to see the Star Rose."
Knotting his right hand into a fist, Skeg bounced it off his thigh to emphasize his words. Aragorn leaned against the hip-high railing in front of him, and watched as 5 dwarves on the opposite side of the gem lowered a 6th dwarf, who was bound in a rope harness, until he hung inches above the sharp edges of the fractured sapphire. Reaching inside his tunic, the suspended dwarf removed a sliver of Isidar Mithrim from a leather wallet, and grasping the sliver with a minuscule set of pincers, fit it into a small gap in the gem below.
"If the coronation were held 3 days from now," said Aragorn, "could you have Isidar Mithram ready by then?"
Skeg drummed the railing with all 10 of his fingers, tapping out a melody Aragorn failed to recognize. The dwarf said,
"We would not rush so with Isidar Mithram if not for the offer of your dragon. This haste is foreign to us, Arjotlar. It is not our nature, as it is humans, to rush about like agitated ants. Still, we shall do our best to have Isidar Mithram ready in time for the coronation. If that should be 3 days from now, well, I should not be too hopeful of our prospects. But if it were later in the week, I think we might be finished."
Aragorn thanked Skeg for his prediction, then took his leave. With his guards trailing after him, Aragorn walked to one of the many common eating halls in the city mountain. A long, low room with stone tables arranged in rows on one side, and dwarves busying themselves about soapstone ovens on the other. There Aragorn dined on sourdough bread, fish with white meat that the dwarves caught in underground lakes, mushrooms, and some sort of mashed tuber that he had eaten before in Trondheim, but whose provenance he had yet to learn. Before he began eating, though, he was careful to test the food for poison, using the spells Oromis had taught him. As Aragorn washed down the last crust of bread with a sip of thin, watered-down breakfast beer, Oric and his contingent of 10 warriors entered the hall. The warriors sat at their own tables, positioning themselves where they could watch both entrances, while Oric joined Aragorn, lowering himself onto the stone bench opposite him with a weary sigh. He placed his elbows on the table and rubbed his face with his hands. Aragorn cast several spells to prevent anyone from eavesdropping, then asked,
"Did we suffer another setback?"
"No, no setback. Only these deliberations are trying in the extreme."
"I noticed."
"And everyone noticed your frustration," said Oric. "You must control yourself better hereafter, Aragorn. Revealing weakness of any sort to our opponents does nothing but further their cause.
Oric fell silent, as a portly dwarf waddled up and deposited a plate of steaming food in front of him. Aragorn scowled at the edge of the table.
"But are you any closer to the throne? Have we gained any ground with all of this long-winded prattle?"
Oric raised a finger while he chewed on a mouthful of bread.
"We have gained a great deal. Do not be so gloomy. After you left, Havard agreed to lower the tax on the salt Durgrim's Fanghur sells to the Injitum in exchange for summer access to our tunnel to Nalsvrid Myrna, so they may hunt the red deer that gather around the lake during the warm months of the year. You should have seen how Nardo gritted his teeth when Havard accepted my offer."
"Bah!" spat Aragorn. "Taxes, deer! What does any of it have to do with who succeeds Hrothgar as ruler?"
"Be honest with me, Oric. What is your position compared with the other clan chiefs? And how much longer is this likely to drag on? With every day that passes, it becomes more likely that the Empire will discover our ruse and Galbatorix will strike at the Varden when I am not there to fend off Murtagh and Thorn." Oric wiped his mouth on the corner of the tablecloth.
"My position is sound enough. None of the Grimstborithen have the support to call a vote. But Nardo and I command the greatest followings. If either of us can win over, say, another 2 or 3 clans, the balance will quickly tip in that person's favour. Havard is already wavering. It won't take too much more encouragement, I think, to convince him to defect to our camp. Tonight we will break bread with him, and I will see what I can do toward providing that encouragement."
Oric devoured a piece of roast mushroom, then said,
"As for when the clan meet will end, maybe after another week if we are lucky, and maybe 2 if we're not."
Aragorn cursed in an undertone. He was so tense, his stomach churned and rumbled and threatened to reject the meal he had just eaten. Reaching across the table, Oric caught Aragorn by the wrist.
"There is nothing you or I can do to further hasten the clan meet's decision," so do not let it upset you overmuch. Worry about what you can change, and leave the rest to sort itself out, eh?"
He released Aragorn. Aragorn slowly exhaled, and leaned on his forearms against the table.
"I know. It's only that we have so little time, and if we fail..."
"What will be,"
said Oric. He smiled, but his eyes were sad and hollow.
"No one can escape fate's design. Couldn't you seize the throne by force? I know you don't have that many troops in Trondheim, but with my support, who could stand against you?"
Oric paused with his knife halfway between his plate and his mouth, then shook his head and resumed eating. Between mouthfuls, he said,
"Such a ploy would prove disastrous."
"Why?"
"Must I explain? Our entire race would turn against us, and instead of seizing control of our nation, I would inherit an empty title. If that came to pass, I would not bet a broken sword we would live to see out the year."
"Ah." Oric said nothing more until the food on his plate was gone. Then he downed a mouthful of beer, belched, and resumed the conversation.
"We are balanced upon a windy mountain path with a mile-high drop on either side. So many of my race hate and fear dragon riders because of the crimes Galbatorix, the Forsworn, and now Murtagh have committed against us. And so many of them fear the world beyond the mountains and the tunnels and caverns wherein we hide."
He turned his mug around on the table.
"Nardo and Aswaldun Rakanuin are only worsening the situation. They play upon people's fears and poison their minds against you, the Varden, and King Orin. Aswaldun Rakanuin is the epitome of what we must overcome if I am to be king. Somehow we must needs find a way to allay their concerns and the concerns of those like them, for even if I am king, I will have to give them a fair hearing if I am to retain the support of the clans. A dwarf, king or queen, is always at the mercy of the clans, no matter how strong a ruler they may be. Just as the Grimes Borithin are at the mercy of the families of their clan."
Tilting back his head, Oric drained the last of the beer from his mug, then set it down with a sharp clack.
"Is there anything I could do? Any custom or ceremony of yours I could perform that would appease Vermund and his followers?"
asked Aragorn, naming the current Grimstborith of Aswaldun Rakanuin.
"There must be something I can do to put their suspicions to rest and bring this feud to an end."
Oric laughed and stood from the table.
"You could die."
Early the next morning, Aragorn sat with his back against the curved wall of the round room set deep below the center of Trondheim, along with a select group of warriors, advisers, servants, and family members of the clan chiefs who were privileged enough to attend the clan meet. The clan chiefs themselves were seated in heavy carved chairs arranged around the edge of a circular table, which, like most objects of note in the lower levels of the city mountain, bore the crest of Corgan and the Ingetum. At the moment Galdheim, Grimstborith of Dúr Grimstfeldunost, was speaking. He was short, even for a dwarf, hardly more than 2 feet in height, and wore patterned robes of gold, russet, and midnight blue. Unlike the dwarves of the Ingetum, he did not trim or braid his beard, and it tumbled across his chest like a tangled bramble. Standing on the seat of his chair, he pounded the polished table with his gloved fist and roared,
"Eta! Narhu Udim etal os issu vond! Narhu Udim etal os form von mendun os braken, as varden hrestfog dur grimstens hadden! As jorgen vren quatrid ne domer on etal..."
"No!"
Aragorn's translator, a dwarf named Hunfast, whispered in his ear.
"I will not let that happen. I will not let these beardless fools, the Varden, destroy our country. The Dragon War left us weak and not..."
Aragorn stifled a yawn, bored. He allowed his gaze to drift around the granite table, from Galdheim to Nardo, a round-faced dwarf with flaxen hair who was nodding with approval at Galdheim's thundering speech. To Havard, who was using a dagger to clean under the fingernails of the two remaining fingers on his right hand. To Vermund, heavy-browed but otherwise inscrutable behind his purple veil. To Ganel and Undin, who sat leaning toward each other, whispering. While Hadfala, an elderly dwarf woman who was the clan chief of Dorgrimst de Bardach and the third member of Ganel's alliance, frowned at the sheaf of rune-covered parchment she brought with her to every meeting. And then to the chief of Dorgrimst Ledwonu, Manandrath, who sat in profile to Aragorn, displaying his long, drooping nose to good effect. To Thordris, Grimstborith of Dorgrimst Nagra, of whom he could see little but her wavy auburn hair, which fell past her shoulders and lay coiled on the floor in a braid twice as long as she was tall. To the back of Oryk's head as he slouched to one side in his chair. To Freowyn, Grimstborith of Dorgrimst Gedthral, an immensely corpulent dwarf who kept his eyes fixed upon the block of wood he was busy carving into the likeness of a hunched raven. And then to Hridamar, Grimstborith of Dorgrimst Urjard, who, in contrast with Freowyn, was fit and compact, with corded forearms, and who wore a mail hauberk and helm to every gathering. And finally, to Eorunan, she of the nut-brown skin, marred only by a thin, crescent-shaped scar high upon her left cheekbone. She of the satin-bright hair, bound underneath a silver helm, wrought in the shape of a snarling wolf's head. She of the vermilion dress and the necklace of flashing emeralds set in squares of gold carved with lines of arcane runes. Eorunan noticed Aragorn looking at her. A lazy smile appeared on her lips. With voluptuous ease, she winked at Aragorn, obscuring one of her almond-shaped eyes for a pair of heartbeats. Aragorn's cheeks stung as blood suffused them, and the tips of his ears burned. He shifted his gaze and returned it to Galdheim, who was still busy pontificating, his chest puffed out like that of a strutting pigeon. As Oryk had asked, Aragorn remained impassive throughout the meeting, concealing his reactions from those who were watching. When the clan meet broke for their midday meal, he hastened over to Oryk, and bending so that no one else could hear, said, "Do not look for me at your table. I have had my fill of sitting and talking. I'm going to explore the tunnels for a bit." Oryk nodded, appearing distracted, and murmured in reply,
"Do as you wish. Only be sure you are here when we resume. It would not be meet for you to play truant, no matter how tedious these talks be."
"As you say."
Aragorn edged out of the conference room, along with the press of dwarves eager to have their lunches, and rejoined his four guards in the hallway outside, where they had been playing dice with idle warriors from other clans. With his guards in tow, Aragorn struck out in a random direction, allowing his feet to carry him where they would, while he pondered methods of welding the dwarves' contentious factions into a whole, united against Galbatorix. To his exasperation, the only methods he could envision were so far-fetched, it was absurd to imagine they might succeed. Aragorn paid little attention to the dwarves he met in the tunnels, aside from mumbled greetings that courtesy occasionally demanded, nor even to his exact surroundings, trusting that Kvaister could guide him back to the conference room. Although Aragorn did not study his surroundings in any great detail visually, he kept track of the minds of every living creature he was able to sense within a radius of several hundred feet, even down to the smallest spider crouched behind its web in the corner of a room. For Aragorn had no desire to be surprised by anyone who might have cause to seek him out. When at last he stopped, he was surprised to find himself in the same dusty room he had discovered during his wanderings the previous day. There to his left were the same five black arches that led to caverns unknown, while there to his right was the same bas-relief carving of the head and shoulders of a snarling bear. Bemused by the coincidence, Aragorn sauntered over to the bronze sculpture and gazed up at the bear's gleaming fangs, wondering what had drawn him back. After a moment, he went to the middle of the five archways and gazed through it. The narrow hallway beyond was devoid of lanterns and soon faded into the soft oblivion of shadow. Reaching out with his consciousness, Eragon probed the length of the tunnel and several of the abandoned chambers it opened to. A half-dozen spiders and a sparse collection of moths, millipedes and blind crickets were the only inhabitants.
"Hello!"
called Eragon, and listened as the hall returned his voice to him with ever-decreasing volume.
"Quaestor," said Eragon, looking at him, "does no one at all live in these ancient parts?"
The fresh-faced dwarf answered,
"Some do. A few strange Nerlin. Those to whom empty solitude is more pleasing than the touch of their wife's hand, or the sound of their friends' voices. It was one such Nerlag who warned us of the approach of the Urgal army, if you remember, Arjatlam. Also, although we do not speak of it often, there are those who have broken the laws of our land, and whom their clan chiefs have banished on pain of death for a term of years, or, if the offence is severe, for the remainder of their lives. All such are as the walking dead to us. We shun them if we meet them outside of our lands, and hang them if we catch them within our borders."
When Quaestor had finished speaking, Eragon indicated that he was ready to leave. Quaestor took the lead, and Eragon followed him out the doorway through which they had entered, the three other dwarfs close behind. They had gone no more than 20 feet, when Eragon heard a faint scuffing from the rear. So faint, Quaestor did not seem to notice. Eragon glanced back. By the amber light cast by the flameless lanterns mounted on either side of the passageway, he saw 7 dwarfs garbed entirely in black, their faces masked with dark cloth and their feet muffled with rags, running toward his group with a speed that Eragon had assumed was the sole province of elves, shades, and other creatures whose blood hummed with magic. In their right hands the dwarves held long sharp daggers with pale blades that flickered with prismatic colours, while in their left each carried a metal buckler with a sharpened spike protruding from the boss. Their minds, like those of the Razak, were hidden from Eragon.
"Saphira!"
was Eragon's first thought. Then he remembered he was alone. Twisting to face the black-garbed dwarves, Eragon reached for the hilt of his falchion while opening his mouth to shout a warning. He was too late. As the first word rang in his throat, 3 of the strange dwarves grabbed the hindmost of Eragon's guards and lifted their glimmering daggers to stab him. Faster than speech or conscious thought, Eragon plunged his whole being into the flow of magic, and without relying upon the ancient language to structure his spell, rewove the fabric of the world into a pattern more pleasing to him. The 3 guards who stood between him and the attackers flew toward him, as if yanked by invisible strings, and landed upon their feet beside him, unharmed but disoriented. Eragon winced at the sudden decrease in his strength. 2 of the black-garbed dwarves rushed him, stabbing at his belly with their blood-hungry daggers. Sword in hand, Eragon parried both blows, stunned by the dwarf's speed and ferocity. 1 of his guards leaped forward, shouting and swinging his axe at the would-be assassins. Before Eragon could grab the dwarf's hauberk and yank him back to safety, a white blade, writhing as with spectral flame, pierced the dwarf's corded neck. As the dwarf fell, Eragon glimpsed his contorted face and was shocked to see Quaestor, and that his throat was glowing molten red as it disintegrated around the dagger.
"I can't let them so much as scratch me," Eragon thought.
Enraged by Quaestor's death, Eragon stabbed at his killer so quickly the black-garbed dwarf had no opportunity to evade the blow and dropped lifeless at Eragon's feet. With all his strength, Eragon shouted, "Stay behind me!" Thin cracks split the floors and walls, and flakes of stone fell from the ceiling as his voice reverberated through the corridor. The attacking dwarves faltered at the unbridled power of his voice, then resumed their offensive. Eragon retreated several yards to give himself room to maneuver free of the corpses and settled into a low crouch, waving the falchion to and fro like a snake preparing to strike. His heart was racing at twice its normal rate, and although the fight had just begun, he was already gasping for breath. The hallway was 8 feet wide, which was wide enough for 3 of his 6 remaining enemies to attack him at once. They spread out, 2 attempting to flank him on the right and the left, while the 3rd charged straight at him, slashing with frenzied speed at Aragorn's arms and legs. Afraid to duel with the dwarves as he would have if they wielded normal blades, Aragorn drove his legs against the floor and jumped up and forward. He spun halfway around and struck the ceiling feet first. He pushed off, spun halfway around again, and landed on his hands and feet a yard behind the 3 dwarves. Even as they whirled toward him, he stepped forward and beheaded the lot of them with a single backhand blow. Their daggers clattered against the floor an instant before their heads. Leaping over their truncated bodies, Aragorn twisted in mid-air and landed on the spot he had started from. It was not a moment too soon. A breath of wind tickled his neck as the tip of a dagger whipped past his throat. Another blade tugged at the cuff of his leggings, cutting them open. He flinched and swung the falchion, trying to gain space to fight.
"My wards should have turned their blades away," he thought, bewildered.
An involuntary cry escaped his throat as his foot struck a patch of slick blood and he lost his balance and toppled over backward. With a sickening crunch, his head collided with the stone floor. Blue lights flashed before his eyes. He gasped. His 3 remaining guards sprang over him and swung their axes in unison, clearing the air above Aragorn and saving him from the bite of the flashing daggers. That was all the time Aragorn needed to recover. He flipped upright and, berating himself for not trying this sooner, shouted a spell laced with 9 of the 12 death words Oromis had taught him. However, the moment after he loosed his magic, he abandoned the spell, for the black-garbed dwarves were protected by numerous wards. Given a few minutes, he might have been able to evade or defeat the wards, but minutes might as well have been days in a battle such as theirs, where every second was as long as an hour. Having failed with magic, Aragorn hardened his thoughts into an iron-hard spear and launched it at where the consciousness of one of the black-garbed dwarves ought to be. The spear skated off mental armor of a sort Aragorn had not encountered before. Smooth and seamless, seemingly unbroken by the concerns natural to mortal creatures engaged in a struggle to the death.
"Someone else is protecting them," Aragorn realized. "There are more behind this attack than just these 7.
Pivoting on 1 foot, Aragorn lunged forward and with his falchion impaled his leftmost attacker in a knee, drawing blood. The dwarf stumbled, and Aragorn's guards converged upon him, grasping the dwarf's arms so he could not swing his dire blade, and hacking at him with their curved axes. The nearest of the last 2 attackers raised his shield in anticipation of the blow Aragorn was about to direct at him. Summoning the full measure of his might, Aragorn cut at the shield, intending to shear it and the arm underneath in half, as he had often done with Zarok. In the fever of battle, though, he forgot to account for the dwarf's inexplicable speed. As the falchion neared its target, the dwarf tilted his shield so as to deflect the blow to the side. 2 plumes of sparks erupted from the surface of the shield as the falchion glanced off the upper part, and then the steel spike mounted in the center. Momentum carried the falchion farther than Aragorn had intended, and it continued flying through the air until it struck edge first against a wall, jarring Aragorn's arm. With a crystalline sound, the blade of the falchion shattered into a dozen pieces, leaving him with a 6-inch spike of jagged metal protruding from the hilt. Dismayed, Aragorn dropped the broken sword and gripped the rim of the dwarf's buckler, resting with him back and forth and struggling to keep the shield between him and the dagger graced with a halo of translucent colors. The dwarf was incredibly tough. He matched Aragorn's efforts and even succeeded in pushing him back a step. Releasing the buckler with his right hand but still holding on with his left, Aragorn drew back his arm and struck the shield as hard as he could, punching through the tempered steel as easily as if it were made of rotten wood. Because of the calluses on his knuckles, he felt no pain from the impact. The force of the blow threw the dwarf against the opposite wall. his head lolling upon a boneless neck, the dwarf dropped to the ground like a puppet whose strings had been severed. Aragorn pulled his hand back through the jagged hole in the shield, scratching himself on the torn metal, and drew his hunting knife. Then the last of the black-garbed dwarves was upon him. Aragorn parried his dagger twice, thrice, and then cut through the dwarf's padded sleeve and scored his dagger arm from the elbow to the wrist. The dwarf hissed with pain, blue eyes furious above his cloth mask. He initiated a series of blows, the dagger whistling through the air faster than the eye could follow, which forced Aragorn to hop away to avoid the deadly edge. The dwarf pressed the attack. For several yards Aragorn succeeded in evading him, until his heel struck a body, and in attempting to step around it, he stumbled and fell against a wall, bruising his shoulder. With an evil laugh, the dwarf pounced, stabbing downward toward Aragorn's exposed chest. Throwing up an arm in a futile attempt to protect himself, Aragorn rolled farther down the hallway, knowing that this time his luck had run out, and he would not be able to escape. As he completed a revolution, and his face was momentarily turned toward the dwarf again, Aragorn glimpsed the pale dagger descending toward his flesh like a bolt of lightning from on high. Then, to his astonishment, the tip of the dagger caught on one of the flameless lanterns mounted on the wall. Aragorn whirled away before he could see more, but an instant later, a burning hot hand seemed to strike him from behind, throwing him a good 20 feet through the hall, until he fetched up against the edge of an open archway, instantly accumulating a new collection of scrapes and bruises. A booming report deafened him. Feeling as if someone were driving splinters into his eardrums, Aragorn clapped his hands over his ears and curled into a ball, howling. When the noise and the pain had subsided, he lowered his hands and staggered to his feet, clenching his teeth as his injuries announced their presence with a myriad of unpleasant sensations. Groggy and confused, he gazed upon the sight of the explosion. The blast had blackened a 10-foot length of the hallway with soot. Soft flakes of ash tumbled through the air, which was as hot as the air from a heated forge. The dwarf who had been about to strike Aragorn lay on the ground, thrashing, his body covered with burns. After a few more convulsions, he grew still. Aragorn's three remaining guards lay at the edge of the soot, where the explosion had thrown them. Even as he watched, they staggered upright, blood dripping from their ears and gaping mouths, their beards singed and in disarray. The links along the fringe of their hauberks glowed red, but their leather under-armour seemed to have protected them from the worst of the heat. Aragorn took a single step forward, then stopped and groaned as a patch of agony bloomed between his shoulder blades. He tried to twist his arm around to feel the extent of the wound, but as his skin stretched, the pain became too great to continue. Nearly losing consciousness, he leaned against the wall for support. He glanced at the burnt dwarf again. I must have suffered similar injuries on my back. Forcing himself to concentrate, he recited two of the spells designed to heal burns that Brom had taught him during their travels. As they took effect, it felt as if cool, soothing water were flowing across his back. He sighed with relief and straightened. "Are you hurt?" he asked, as his guards hobbled over. The lead dwarf frowned, tapped his right ear and shook his head. Aragorn muttered a curse, and only then did he notice he could not hear his own voice. Again, drawing upon the reserves of energy within his body, he cast a spell to repair the inner mechanisms of his ears and of theirs. As the incantation concluded, an irritating itch squirmed inside his ears, then faded along with the spell. "Are you hurt?" The dwarf on the right, a burly fellow with a forked beard, coughed and spat out a glob of congealed blood, then growled,
"Nothing that time won't mend. What of you, Shadeslayer?"
"I live."
Testing the floor with every step, Aragorn entered the soot-blackened area and knelt beside Kvaistor, hoping that he might still save the dwarf from the clutches of death. As soon as he beheld Kvaistor's wound again, he knew it was not to be. Aragorn bowed his head, the memory of recent and former bloodshed bitter to his soul. He stood.
Why did the lantern explode?
They are filled with heat and light, Arjitlam, one of his guards replied. If they are broken, all of it escapes at once, and then it is better to be far away.
Gesturing at the crumpled corpses of their attackers, Aragorn asked, Do you know of which clan they are? The dwarf with a forked beard rifled through the clothes of several of the black-garbed dwarves, then said,
Barzul! They carry no marks upon them such as you would recognize, Arjitlam. But they carry this.
He held up a bracelet made of braided horsehair, set with polished cabochons of amethyst.
What does it mean?
This amethyst,
said the dwarf, and tapped one of the cabochons with a soot-streaked fingernail.
This particular variety of amethyst. It grows in only four parts of the Beor Mountains, and three of them belong to Asweldin Rac Anuin.
Aragorn frowned.
Grimst Borith Vermund ordered this attack?
I cannot say for sure, Arjitlam. Another clan might have left the bracelet for us to find. They might want us to think it was Asweldin Rac Anuin, so we do not realize who our foes really are. But if I had to wager, Arjitlam, I would wager a cartload of gold that it is Asweldin Rac Anuin who is responsible.
Blast them, Aragorn murmured. Whoever it was, blast them.
He clenched his fists to stop them from shaking. With the side of his boot, he nudged one of the prismatic daggers the assassins had wielded.
The spells on these weapons, and on the men,
he motioned with his chin.
Men, dwarves, be as it may, they must have required an incredible amount of energy. And I cannot even imagine how complex their wording was. Casting them would have been hard and dangerous.
Aragorn looked at each of his guards in turn and said,
As you are my witnesses, I swear I shall not let this attack nor Kvaistr's death go unpunished. Whichever clan or clans sent these dung-faced killers, when I learn their names, they will wish they had never thought to strike at me. And by striking at me, strike at Durgrimstin Jeetum. This I swear to you as a dragon rider and as a fellow member of Durgrimstin Jeetum. And if any ask you of it, repeat my promise to them as I have given it to you.
The dwarves bowed before him, and he with the forked beard replied,
As you command, so we shall obey, Arjitlam. You honor Hrothgar's memory by your words.
Then another of the dwarfs said,
Whichever clan it was, they have violated the law of hospitality. They have attacked a guest. They are not even so high as rats. They are Menurlin.
He spat on the floor, and the other dwarfs spat with him. Aragorn walked to where the remains of his falchion lay. He knelt in the soot, and with the tip of a finger touched one of the pieces of metal, tracing its ragged edges.
I must have hit the shield and the wall so hard, I overwhelmed the spells I used to reinforce the steel, he thought.
Then he thought,
I need a sword. I need a rider's sword.
A matter of perspective. The wind of morning heat above flat land, which was different from the wind of morning heat above hills, shifted. Sephira adjusted the angle of her wings to compensate for the changes in the speed and pressure of the air that supported her weight thousands of feet above the sun-bathed land below. She closed her double eyelids for a moment, luxuriating in the soft bed of the wind, as well as the warmth of the morning rays beating down upon her sinewy length. She imagined how the light must make her scales sparkle, and how those who saw her circling in the sky must marvel at the sight, and she hummed with pleasure, content in the knowledge that she was the most beautiful creature in Alagazia,
for who could hope to match the glory of her scales, and her long, tapering tail, and her wings, so fair and well-formed, and her curved claws, and her long white fangs, with which she could sever the neck of a wild ox with a single bite? Not Glader of the Gold Scales, who had lost a leg during the fall of the riders, nor could Thorn nor Shrooken, for they were both slaves to Galbatorix, and their forced servitude had twisted their minds. A dragon who was not free to do as he or she wished was not a dragon at all. Besides, they were males, and while males might appear majestic, they could not embody the beauty she did. No, she was the most stunning creature in Alagaesia, and that was as it should be. Sapphira wriggled with satisfaction all the way from the base of her head to the tip of her tail. Today was a perfect day. The heat of the sun made her feel as if she were lying in a nest of coals. Her belly was full, the sky was clear, and there was nothing she needed to attend to, besides watching for foes who might wish to fight, which she did anyway as a matter of habit. Her happiness had only one flaw, but it was a profound flaw, and the longer she considered it, the more discontented she grew, until she realized she was no longer satisfied. She wished Aragorn were there to share the day with her. She growled and loosed a brief jet of blue flame from between her jaws, searing the air in front of her, then constricted her throat, cutting off the stream of liquid fire. Her tongue tingled from the flames that had run over it. When was Aragorn, partner of her mind and heart, Aragorn, going to contact Nasawada from Trondheim and ask for her, Sapphira, to join him? She had urged him to obey Nasawada and travel to the mountains higher than she could fly, but now too long had passed and Sapphira felt cold and empty in her gut.
"There is a shadow in the world," she thought. "That is what has upset me. Something is wrong with Aragorn. He is in danger, or he was in danger recently, and I cannot help him."
She was not a wild dragon. Since she had hatched, she had shared her entire life with Aragorn, and without him, she was only half herself. If he died because she was not there to protect him, she would have no reason to continue living, save for revenge. She knew she would tear his killers apart, and then she would fly on the black city of the Eggbreaker traitor who had kept her imprisoned for so many decades, and she would do her best to slay him, no matter that it would mean certain death for her. Sapphira growled again and snapped at a tiny sparrow that was foolish enough to fly within range of her teeth. She missed, and the sparrow darted past and continued on its way unmolested, which only exacerbated her foul mood. For a moment she considered chasing the sparrow, but then decided it was not worth bothering herself over such an inconsequential speck of bones and feathers. It would not even make a good snack. Tilting on the wind, and swinging her tail in the opposite direction to facilitate her turn, she wheeled around, studying the ground far below, and all the small, scurrying things that strove to hide from her hunter's eyes. Even from her height of thousands of feet, she could count the number of feathers on the back of a chicken hawk that was skimming the fields of planted wheat west of the Jeet River. She could see the blur of brown fur as a rabbit dashed to the safety of its warren. She could pick out the small herd of deer cowering underneath the branches of the currant bushes, clustered along a tributary of the Jeet River. And she could hear the high-pitched squeaks of frightened animals warning their brethren of her presence. Their wavering cries gratified her. It was only right that her food should fear her. If ever she should fear it, she would know it was her time to die. A league farther upstream, the Varden were packed against the Jeet River like a herd of red deer against the edge of a cliff. The Varden had arrived at the crossing yesterday, and since then, perhaps a third of the men who were friends, and the Urgals who were friends, and the horses she must not eat, had forded the river. The army moved so slowly, she sometimes wondered how humans ever had time to do anything other than travel, considering how short their lives were.
"It would be much more convenient if they could fly," she thought,
and wondered why they did not choose to. Flying was so easy, it never ceased to puzzle her why any creature would remain earthbound. Even Aragorn retained his attachment to the soft, hard ground, when she knew he could join her in the sky at any time, merely by uttering a few words in the ancient language. But then she did not always understand the actions of those who tottered about on two legs, whether they had round ears, pointed ears, or horns, or were so short she could squash them under her feet. A flicker of movement to the northeast caught her attention, and she angled toward it, curious. She saw a line of 45 weary horses trudging toward the Varden. Most of the horses were riderless. Therefore it did not occur to her until another half hour had elapsed and she could make out the faces of the men in the saddles that the group might be Rorans returning from their raid. She wondered what had happened to so reduce their numbers and felt a momentary twinge of unease. She was not bonded to Roran, but Aragorn cared for him, and that was reason enough for her to worry about his well-being. Pushing her consciousness down toward the disorganized Varden, she searched until she found the music of Arya's mind. And once the elf acknowledged her and allowed access to her thoughts, Saphira said,
"Roran shall be here by late afternoon. However, his company is sore diminished. Some great evil befell them this trip."
"Thank you, Saphira," said Arya. "I shall inform Nasawada."
As Saphira withdrew from Arya's mind, she felt the questing touch of black-blue wolf-hair Blodgarm.
"I am not a hatchling," she snapped. "You need not check on my health every few minutes."
"You have my most humble apologies, Bjartskule. Only you have been gone for quite some time now. And if any are watching, they will begin to wonder why you and..."
"Yes, I know,"
she growled. Shortening her wingspan, she tilted downward, the sensation of weight leaving her, and gyrated in slow spirals as she dove toward the turgid river.
"I shall be there shortly."
1,000 feet above the water, she flared her wings and felt the strain in her flight membranes as the wind pressed against them with immense force. She slowed to a near standstill, then spilled air from her wings and accelerated once more, gliding to within 100 feet of the brown, not-good-to-drink water. With an occasional flap to maintain her altitude, she flew up the Jeet River, alert for the sudden changes of pressure that plagued cool air above flowing water, and that could push her in an unexpected direction, or worse, into sharp, pointy trees, or the breakbone ground. She swept high above the Varden gathered next to the river, high enough that her arrival would not unduly frighten the silly horses. Then drifting downward upon still wings, she landed in a clearing among the tents, a clearing Nasawada had ordered set aside just for her, and crawled through the camp to Aragorn's empty tent, where Blodgarm and the 11 other elves he commanded were waiting for her. She greeted them with a blink of her eyes and a flick of her tongue, and then curled up in front of Aragorn's tent, resigned to dozing and waiting for dark, as she would if Aragorn were actually in the tent and he and she were flying missions at night. It was dull, tedious work lying there day after day, but it was necessary in order to maintain the deception that Aragorn was still with the Varden. So Saphira did not complain, even if after 12 or more hours spent on the rough, hard ground, dirtying her scales, she felt like fighting 1,000 soldiers, or raising a forest with tooth and claw and fire, or leaping up and flying until she could fly no more, or until she reached the end of earth, water, and air. Growling to herself, she kneaded the ground with her claws, softening it, then lay her head across her forelegs and closed her inner eyelids so she could rest and still watch those who walked by. A dragonfly buzzed over her head, and not for the first time she wondered what could have possibly inspired some feeble-minded runtling to name the insect after her race.
It looks nothing like a dragon, she grumbled,
then drifted off into a light sleep.
The big round fire in the sky was close to the horizon when Saphira heard the shouts and cries of welcome that meant Roran